accession number 10657, reel 24.
Major Lewis, reel 24. I think you were saying that you were approaching the Marath line.
Yes. before that, I'll just say that we did get a reinforcement draft came in at Benina, which included myself. There were seven of. Okay. No, I think we had seven officers and 100 other ranks. The officers included Major Chambers, myself. Lieutenant Neil, Lucas and Wheatley. And very soon after that, General Horrocks, who commanded 10th Corps, visited the battalion. By then he was a familiar and very popular figure with 50 Div. Everybody thought a great deal of him. We thought we'd got the right chap up there running a corps. He was very friendly when he came around and talked to people. He would make a point of talking to all sorts of different people, not just battalion commanders and company commanders, but section leaders, pioneer platoon, MT drivers, all that sort of thing. And he was genuinely interested and concerned. I don't think I mentioned that we had a divisional concert party. It was run by a chap named Stringer Davis. He was a lieutenant, and in fact his wife was Margaret Rutherford. And Stringer put on some marvellous shows from the back of converted 3-ton lorries. And this also was something that was very good for the troops' morale. Even better, of course, it was a red letter occasion, was when we had an ENSA concert party. And an ENSA concert party did in fact come out to Benina. And we found the following morning that all our reserves of whiskey and gin in the officers' mess had in fact been consumed. But it was worthwhile because it was a jolly good ENSA party, and there again it was well worthwhile, something well worthwhile doing for the troops.
Do you remember who was in it?
No, I don't remember, but it could have been two of the girls. There were a couple of sisters. I know they were in Tripoli at the time, Carol and Bonnie Downs, D-O-W-N-S. And they're the only names I actually remember. They weren't terribly well-known people, but they were all good at what they were doing. And they were a full-scale concert party, not just from the back of the three-tonner.
What sort of things did they do in such a show? You know, what format
was it? The usual stuff, you know, telling jokes and singing and playing the piano and maybe doing a bit of dancing. That sort of thing. It was all pretty light variety stuff. They didn't do nothing like plays or anything like that. It had to be something the troops could join in with, you know, could join in with the singing and all that sort of thing.
Like a travelling music hall.
More or less, that's right, yes. And I think also they were in Tripoli, and they gave shows in Tripoli as well at one of the theatres.
What did the divisional concert party do then? What sort of
Well, the Div concert party just went round with the 3-ton lorry to units of the division that were out of the line, and their job was just do this all the time and going to rest areas, and maybe if you'd got a large B echelon, which was a B echelon for 3 battalions, maybe they would go there.
Did they have a similar sort of show to put on?
Well, they were a bit more restricted. You know, from the back of a 3-tonner, it was very much restricted. I'd have thought you'd probably down to a piano there and a chap telling a few jokes and perhaps a bit of a sing-song. So they did what, you know, the best they could with the limited facilities, as it were.
Did you ever see films?
Can't remember that we did, no. Can't remember seeing a film. Only did see films, but they were way back down in the base depot at Geneva before I even went up into the desert. They'd got cinemas there. Can't remember what the films were, but that's about as far as the films went. So the battalion left Benina on March the 2nd. It was a 900-mile journey to an assembly area in the vicinity of the Marath Line. Most of the way they went along the main coast road. The column pulled into a staging area in the early afternoon and were usually left the next morning at about 8 o'clock. The coast road followed the Gulf of Sirte, and every few yards there were stacks of disarmed enemy mines. The Germans showed a tremendous number of mines when they were in a withdrawal situation. And all of these things had to be disarmed, of course. And you've got these stacks of mines at the side of the road, which showed just how many had been sown. I remember a notice in Sirte, as we went through Sirte, it simply said, "Sirte is dirty with mines and booby traps." If you did go off the road in a jeep or a lorry or whatever, in an area that hadn't been marked clear of mines, then the odds were you would most certainly go up on one. There were knocked out guns and tanks and lots of little newly dug graves, mounds of earth with wooden crosses on top of them, which simply emphasised the ferocity of the fighting between the German rear guards and our advanced troops. It was also fairly sobering when you see this sort of thing and you're going along in the direction where it's all happening. It does make people go a little bit quiet for a while.
Did they also do demolitions at all, besides sowing mines?
I don't think there were so many. I can't remember there were any bridges or anything to cross, actually. No, I think it was mainly a mine operation. Up as far as Marath, anyway. On the 9th of March, we skirted Tripoli. We didn't go into the town. And by now, we were getting palm trees, irrigated land, strips of cultivated land, which, of course, was a very welcome change from the desert, and these little tiny villas which had been occupied by the Italian settlers with their little bits of garden in the front and everything. The whole thing began to look a little bit civilised. And on the 13th of March, the battalion arrived in a reserve area only a few miles behind the forward elements of the 8th Army. So we had arrived behind the Marath line, or not far from the Marath line. That's that one. the information that we did know about the line was that it was in Tunisia, and it was really a mini Maginot line. The system of defences was quite unique in the African theatre of war. It was something that nobody had come up against previously. It had originally been built by the French to protect Tunisia against attack by the Italians from Libya. It ran for 22 miles from a place near Zarat, which was slightly in from the coast, to the Matmata Hills, which in fact were considered by the Germans to be a natural barrier to wheeled transport. In the coastal sector, the line was based on the Wadi Zigzal. That's W-A-D-I and then Z-I-G-Z-A-O-U. Probably one of the most formidable anti-tank obstacles ever. It had been widened and deepened to form a colossal natural anti-tank ditch. The wadi was covered by enfilade fire along its entire length, from concrete and steel pillboxes, gun emplacements, and blockhouses. And the pillboxes, blockhouses, what have you, were supported by a very deep trench system linked with deep dugouts and funk holes. Now, on the far side of the wadi, and before getting to the forts and everything, there was an anti-tank ditch. Now, the anti-tank ditch itself was 12 feet wide, 12 feet deep, I'm sorry, and 15 foot wide. And as I say, it lay between the wadi and the main defence line. The whole area was heavily sown with Teller, which are the big German anti-vehicle mines, anti-personnel mines, and shrapnel mines. The French had always maintained that the Maginot Line could not be outflanked. But way back in January of 1943, the long-range desert group had found a way round the defences. And General Montgomery's plan, which was scheduled for March the 20th, was for the 50th Division and the 23rd Armoured Brigade to make a frontal attack in the coastal sector, whilst the New Zealand Corps delivered a left hook and outflanked the Marrieth Line, which the French said couldn't be done, but the LRDG reckoned it could, and so did the Army commander. Having done this, they would then push on to an objective in the Gabes area, G-A-B-E-S. Now, in support of this divisional and armoured brigade attack in the north and the New Zealanders down south, every available bomber and fighter in the Desert Air Force was to give support. Unfortunately, this support was not forthcoming at a later stage in the battle, which I will describe later on, because of very, very heavy downpours of rain and storms. But first of all, the main thing was to do was to drive in the few outposts in front of the Wadi Zigzag that the Italians had established.
How far ahead were those?
Oh, I would say pretty close into the wadi, really. They were only, I think, slit trenches or something of that nature, where somebody could go and get back immediately they spotted anything happening. I don't think they were put there to try and hold anybody up. I think they were purely as a warning signal.
Well, were they connected by any sort of covered way or communication trench?
No, I don't think so. I think we would have noticed that. I can't recollect that they were. I mean, it could well be that they were nothing really more than a few guys on our side of the actual wadi.
Sound like listening posts.
Yes, more like listening posts than anything else, an observation post, I think. But, and I cannot recollect that we ever saw any, actually. But they had to be knocked in. And I think on the 16th and 17th March, 69th Brigade, off 50 Div, part of 51 Div, which was the Scottish Division, and the 201 Guards Brigade did the job. Now, that wasn't in our sector, in actual fact. I don't think very much happened in our sector, which makes me think that they could only have been very, very small. I mean, I don't remember any troops coming through to deal with them. And it implies that it was on the 69 Brigade front, off to the left. The guards, in fact, suffered very heavy casualties in the minefields leading down to the Zigzag. Now, having accomplished this, the next thing was that 50 Div got ready for the main assault. The plan was for the 69th Brigade would attack some newly constructed strong points, this is interesting, on the British side of the wadi, but it was in the 69th Brigade area that these strong points on our side of the wadi were, not in our area. Whilst 151 Brigade on the right flank, that's the three Downer battalions, would cross the Wadi and capture two large forts, known as Wurzi, O-U-E-R-Z-I, and Kasiba S, K-S-I-B-A and E-S-T. The Royal Engineers were then to bridge the Wadi with causeways so that the Valentines of the 23rd Armoured Brigade could get forward to the infantry. The weight of artillery support, although it didn't go on for so long, it was planned would be similar to Alamein.
When did you get all this information yourself? Did you get early briefings on the...
We got a pretty good briefing, actually, but it wasn't until March the 19th. I can tell you about that in a minute, actually. I wanted to explain, first of all, that the LOB, which means left out of battle, before any big show, there were always a number of officers and some experienced troops who were left out to form the first line reinforcements. And this was known as LOB. Now, Colonel Lidwell, Bob Lidwell, L-I-D-W-I-L-L, who had joined the battalion at Alamein and had subsequently done extremely well, was by that time the second in command of the 8th Battalion. Fortunately for the 8th Battalion, Bob Lidwell wouldn't stay away. He was sent LOB, but he came back every time he got an inkling that there was going to be a conference or a discussion or a briefing. He would appear on the scene. He wouldn't stay back LOB. And it was a good job he did, because he got himself pretty well clued up about what the whole plan was, and this was invaluable to him at a later stage in the battle when he had to take over the battalion. Now, by the 18th of March, our troops were within 100 yards of the Zigzag, but we needed more information about defences on the battalion front and also a little bit of information as to how best to get across the Wadi Zigzag, which had very steep banks on either side, almost unscalable in parts.
Were these banks of sand or rock?
Yes, all part of... mostly sand, but a little bit of a mixture, sand and rock in actual fact. Two night patrols went out the night of March 18, 19, one by Lieutenant Shepherd of A Company and one by Rory O'Connor of C Company. Now, they went down almost as far as the Wadi, but they didn't go onto the banks of the Wadi. They came back and they reported that, so far as they could see, there was no minefield on the British side of the Wadi.
Not in your sector?
Not in our sector. However, they were able to recce from a little bit back from the Wadi what could be the most suitable crossing places, where in fact the banks were not quite so high. The CO gave his orders out on the 19th of March. That was after these two officers had made a recce of the Wadi. Now, his orders were actually given in a Wadi after a pep talk from the brigadier to the officers. Now, at this stage, it might be a good idea to mention the fact that the brigadier was Brigadier Beake, B-E-A-K-E, I think it was, and I think he was VC, DSO, MC from the First World War. I believe he had been on Malta, but he was commanding the brigade. And he gave the officers a pep talk, which I must admit I can't remember anything at all about that. But this was before the CO gave out his orders. Now, the CO told us that the 9th Battalion would be on the right flank of the brigade attack, and their job would be to capture one of the forts. Now, the 8th Battalion, on the left of the 9th, had got to take the Wurzi Fort and a strong point known as Little Wurzi, which we'd mentioned before. When these objectives had been gained, the idea was to get the Valentines across, followed by the 6th DLI, who would attack through the 8th and the 9th to extend the depth of the bridgehead. We were told that, as usual, Italians held the line. When I say, as usual, they held the line, what happened was that they held the line and the Germans got in where, into the vital places where their backing was required, or it was where they were necessary, where it was thought it was better to have German troops. But we were told also that they were Italian bersaglieri troops of the fascist, of the young fascist division, with, as I say, German backing for the vital places. Now, we were also told that our old adversaries of Gazala and Alamein, the 90th Light Division, were astride the main road in the area of the forts, and in reserve behind them was the whole of the 15th Panther Division, which looked a little bit...
must have been a fairly intimidating picture.
A very intimidating picture, especially when you looked at the Wadi from our side, which we were able to do a little later on. Now, the battalion plan was for Charlie Company on the right to take Little Wurzsee, and A Company on the left to take Wurzsee. My company was to be held in reserve to support A Company when I was called forward. Now, both the assault companies, A and C, had a Scorpion tank. Now, this was the first time that the Scorpions, that we had worked with the Scorpions, and it may well be the first time that the Scorpions were used. They were, in fact, flail tanks. They had a sort of roller, like a damn great garden roller on the front of the tank, which was activated by the movement forward of the tank, and these great chains flailed round, and the idea was that they would explode any mines in the path of the tank. Quite apart from anything else, they sent up such a lot of mess of dust and muck and everything that they blinded the tanks to a certain extent. But A and C Company had a Scorpion. The idea was to move 100 yards ahead of them as far as the Wadi, bearing in mind that it was quite impossible for tanks to get across the Wadi at that stage because the causeways hadn't been built. And basically what the tanks had to do was to leave a cleared lane as far as the Wadi for the infantry to get down to the Wadi and not suffer casualties from the mines. Now, the only way to do this, you couldn't have all the infantry spread out, so it was decided that they would go down 100 yards behind the Scorpions in threes. Now, that is a highly unpopular method, so far as the troops are concerned anyway, of advancing anywhere, especially when you're as close as that to a battle situations. But it was considered to be the only safe thing to do.
Because there'd only be a narrow track cleared.
Right. And you were actually moving on a tape. But in threes, I mean, everybody could see the tape then. But the main thing was to keep behind the tanks. They would shield the infantry from the mines. But it was an awkward formation. Everybody thought it was, and there was a lot of moaning about it. But it was the only safe one. Well, now, during the CO's orders, he then came out with something which shook us all rigid. Colonel Jackson said, "We're going to want someone with a lantern to walk in front of the Scorpions to lead them as far as the Wadi when the barrage starts." And of course there was a dead silence. Everybody recognised it immediately as a suicide mission. I mean, the Scorpions were very, very noisy. They were massive great things. They would draw fire of every enemy gun as soon as they started moving. But as against that, the Scorpions would never get to the Wadi without a guiding light. night because they would blind themselves, and the infantry would have to risk the mines without them. Anyway, after looking around at everybody, and I mean, we were lucky. Company commanders were rather fortunate. We knew we weren't going to be picked on, but there were quite a lot of people at this Oak Group, including the supporting arms. And Colonel Jackson said, right, he said, I think this is a job for Lieutenant Douglas. Now, poor old Bill Douglas was second in command of the carrier platoon. And he actually went in the space of a few seconds, absolutely white as a sheet. Now, his face was an absolute picture. And everybody laughed. Now, we weren't laughing at Bill at all. We were laughing, really, out of relief, or most of the people at that Oak Group were, that they hadn't been chosen to do this awful job. And of course this infuriated Bill Douglas, who didn't think it was at all funny. Anyway,
what sort of speed would the Scorpions move?
Pretty slowly. They really did lumber along very slowly. I mean, you could walk no quicker than you walk when you're walking slowly. Now, as well as the flails to help us with the mines, each of the companies had an NCO and three sappers with mine detector and Bangalore torpedoes for minefield clearance. In support of the 8th Battalion, we had our old friends of 74th Field Regiment, that's 296 Battery, one section of 505 Field Company, which was our field company, A Company, that's Apple Company, of the 2nd Cheshires, and 107 Anti-Tank Battery of the Northumberland Hussars. You will see later on that we never ever had most of that support, but that comes a little later on. Now, morning of March the 20th was a lovely, clear, sunny day, and just before midday there were 18 medium bombers flew over us, and they were on a bombing mission over the German lines. We could hear the German ack-ack, which was very intense, and one of the bombers was hit, and we watched the crew bail out one after the other, because it wasn't very far away actually, with a sort of, I don't know how to describe it, but you sort of watch things like that with a kind of detached indifference. It isn't happening to us. It's like somebody else is playing some sort of charade, and you just sit back and watch it. We felt sorry for the guys in the plane, but as I say, it wasn't happening with us, so we just looked up and watched the parachutes come down, and then about a minute later there was a damn great boom when the plane hit the ground and exploded. But that was that. And in the afternoon, the company commanders were taken up to have a close look at the Wadi and the enemy defences on the far side. We had to crawl on our bellies to a 5th East Yorks post within a few hundred yards of the Wadi. So we were in fact looking at the other side, not in our area. The section commander was thoroughly fed up. He'd have the divisional commander up there, the brigade commander, the COs of each of the three Darren battalions, and as a result of which his little post had been shelled to a certain extent, fortunately without causing any casualties, but very unpleasant. He said he didn't mind if people kept their heads down. He said, but when the div commander came up here and the brigadier, he said they bobbed about all over the bloody place and didn't even take the red tabs off their hats.
So they'd been spotted by the enemy.
Not half. A very silly thing to do, actually, and a very thoughtless thing to do, you know. But that was a fact. That sort of thing happened. From this trench, we had a very good view of the Wadi and the defences on the far side. But as I say, we weren't looking at the bit that we were going to attack.
What could you actually see, though? I mean, looking, you say you use binoculars, and so you were looking across the Wadi.
We were on this side of the Wadi. We were looking, we weren't very far from the actual Wadi itself, and we could see the anti-tank ditch on the far side, and we could see the forts and that dotted around on the other side of the anti-tank ditch. We could see barbed wire and a bit of concrete emplacements, and in the background, of course, the high hills of a mountain, almost a mountain range.
You say they're forts. What form did these forts take? Were they?
Well, they were very, very similar. I mean, underground, with basically some of them were actually at ground level with the firing apertures just above ground level, as though you were dealing with dug-in tanks. And they were linked, as I say, with these very, very steep, very, very deep trenches.
So you've got concrete emplacements.
Concrete emplacements and pillboxes and deep trenches, not necessarily straight, weaving about all over the place, and funk holes and that sort of thing. So it was a pretty complex layout, defence layout, and a very difficult one to clear and keep clear without having to do it all over again.
Why was that?
Because they came back in again, and I'll explain that later on, but in the A Company area, once they'd been cleared out of a particular thing, it wasn't feasible for our chaps to occupy it. They were too vulnerable then, so they pulled back again, and as soon as they pulled back, the Germans or the Italians or whoever came back in again. And again, another party had to go out and deal with them. And this went on several times on the A Company front.
Did you have diagrams, complete layout of the...
No, nothing like that at all. I mean, we knew roughly, I mean, I suppose aerial, some form of maybe aerial reconnaissance,